It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is back on Monday. Coming up, President Obama broached the idea of mandatory voting in the U.S. this week. We'll hear your thoughts on the idea. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news with news guy Noah Ovshinsky. Lots of state budget in the news this week with the Joint Finance Committee hearings on the governor's budget proposal and concerns over cuts to UW funding and making the system a public authority. WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky joins us now to talk about the biggest headlines from around the state this week. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here, Rob, and as always, happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well. Well, we've heard that Ringo Starr's tour is coming to Wisconsin, a speculation about the Rolling Stones tour coming here. The big tour in Wisconsin this week, though, is the Joint Finance Committee.
Indeed. They are making their way around the state both this week and next week. The Joint Finance Committee, again, one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, committee in the state legislature. They held a hearing in Brilliant earlier in the week and are actually meeting at this hour at Alverno College in Milwaukee. And this is really a chance for the public to weigh in on, you know, the many aspects of this proposed budget.
And there are many aspects. This is a big document, a lot to talk about. What topics are coming up most often?
Well, K-12 funding was certainly a big topic in Brilliant. That was on a lot of people's minds. In fact, I'd say it was probably one of the issues that really dominated the discussion. Public school advocates came out in force, including administrators, and they argued that the governor's plan to cut funding in the first year of the budget and then keep in place revenue caps would actually dramatically affect the educational opportunities that are available to public school students around the state.
Mm-hmm. And then there's been talk about funding for schools, property taxes, that sort of thing. How's that received, I guess, by people talking at this?
Right. Well, so these public school advocates argue that the governor's plan to cut property taxes on a median home by about $10 to really pay for this cut, it just wasn't worth it, that this $10 decrease in property taxes wasn't worth the cut that it would mean to public schools. Here is Shawano School District business manager Luis Fisher.
Honestly, are any of us going to hold this budget, the governor or you, in high regard because it saved us the cost of a Friday night fish fry?
There was, she again saying, strongly suggesting that the price of a fish fry, you know, is that really worth, you know, the kinds of cuts that we're looking at for public schools around the state?
That's education. What was maybe number two on the word cloud list of things that came up at this first hearing?
Yeah, advocates for the elderly and people with disabilities also spoke out against a proposed restructuring of long-term care programs like IRIS and family care. Some advocates are arguing that the changes give disabled people less of a voice in their care. Now, there aren't a lot of details about what exactly these changes will look like under the governor's proposal, so definitely stay tuned in on that issue. Of course, that's something that was brought up in Brilliant, and it will likely be brought up in other hearings as well.
And there, people have been bringing up objections to plan changes for the DNR. Was that something that came up in this first JFC hearing?
Yes, several people took issue with the governor's plan to take power away from the Natural Resources Board. Others took issue with the fact that the governor was proposing to make so many changes to the agency, given so much of its budget actually was paid for by user fees. They didn't understand that, you know, if so small a part of a budget, you know, that the DNR is, you know, they didn't understand that the governor was proposing so many changes. Actually, here is Mike Arrowwood. He's a member of Wisconsin's Conservation Congress.
Why is the governor messing with my money, okay? My money and the tens of thousands of people like me, the 1.6 million people that fish in the state of Wisconsin, the 650,000 people that deer hunt every year in the state of Wisconsin, why mess with our money?
And what were some of the other DNR concerns, specific concerns that people had?
Yeah, other issues that came up were a plan to cut DNR scientist jobs, a plan to end state funding for Wisconsin State Park System. People testified against both of those proposals. So again, the DNR too, I'd say one of the top five big topics that people are talking about when it comes to this budget.
So that was Brilliant earlier this week on Milwaukee Today. What's next for this Joint Finance Committee tour, Noah?
Yeah, two more meetings are scheduled, one in Rice Lake on Monday, and the hearings wrap up next Thursday in Reedsburg. And as I mentioned, later on in the show, we'll hear from Chuck Kornbach, who's going to be filing a story from Milwaukee about the hearing that is ongoing there.
Well, one of the big budget items that's gotten a lot of attention, UW, and some news came out about that attached to these joint finance hearings.
Right. So in Brilliant earlier this week, we heard from Representative John Nygren, who is the co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, and he brought up this issue of the proposed cuts to UW and the plan to essentially create a public authority for the UW. And he said that he was working on a plan to actually remove the public authority from the budget while at the same time shrinking this proposed $300 million cut.
Yeah, this is something that it looks like will not pass the legislature in the form that Governor Walker intended. So what are we hearing about? I don't know if all the specifics are in, but what kind of changes are we talking about here?
Right. Well, Representative Nygren and other influential legislators have expressed concern that so many stakeholders have actually come out against this idea of a public authority. The UW-Madison Faculty Senate does not support it. Hundreds of staff, students, and faculty from around the system signed a petition urging President Raycross to put off the authority, you know, until more details are worked out and until it's more deeply studied. Nygren essentially argues that the system is just not ready for this kind of independence that the public authority would provide.
And Representative Nygren, not the only legislative leader this week expressing concern on this.
Yeah, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss also weighing in on this issue. He said that there was really no point to create an authority if the regents were going to maintain, you know, tenure and shared governance, which they said they would do if a public authority was created. You know, Speaker Voss basically says, you know, changes to those particular items would make the system more efficient. You know, his lack of support for this public authority, it does not help its chances. Let's just say that much.
And any specifics from Representative Nygren, you mentioned earlier, on how he would lower the cut, make the cut smaller for the UW system?
Yeah, he hasn't released any specific plan yet, but he has said it may involve raising out-of-state tuition, among other things. Voss and other lawmakers have said if tax collections in May exceed expectations, they would be open to shrinking the cut. But Nygren says his plan won't rely on that extra money if it, in fact, comes through.
Hey, Representative Nygren will be on the Joy Cardine Show talking to Cynthia Schuster, actually, Monday at 7:30. And we'll hear more about the shared governance and tenure issues coming up in just a little over 15 minutes here on Central Time. Police-involved shootings, heavily in the news. They intersect a little bit with this budget proposal this week.
Right. So in its budget request, the DOJ, Department of Justice, asked for $700,000 to hire more staff to investigate these officer-involved deaths. A new state law actually requires outside investigations of these kinds of cases. And, you know, the agency has proven to be really the go-to place for these kinds of investigations, you know, as opposed to sheriff's departments or, you know, city police departments. The governor's original budget did not include the money the DOJ asked for. This week, Walker's office says it is now open to providing the money it's asking for.
Now, one point that confused me a little, there's another way for them to request this, the Department of Justice, to request this funding?
Right. So the DOJ could request it actually directly through a request through the Joint Finance Committee. So that's also possible. Regardless of how this, you know, plays out, whether it goes through the governor's office or directly to the Joint Finance Committee, the DOJ, it's looking like it will get more money to investigate officer-involved deaths. And, of course, this comes at a time when we've had one high-profile death and one high-profile shooting, one in Madison and one in Kenosha.
And then another law enforcement story, raises for state troopers.
Yeah, so the state troopers in their latest proposed contract asked for an average raise of about 17%. A legislative committee this week turned down that request. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald says, you know, it was too high and that he couldn't find support for it in his caucus.
And this is in the context of raises not that high for most state employees?
Yeah. So the troopers are asking for this raise at a time when, you know, raises for other state workers, if they are approved, are generally, you know, in the low single digits. So 17% obviously sticks out for many of these lawmakers.
Mm-hmm. And what did the union say in response?
Well, the union said that they will go back to the table, but that there's no guarantee that what they come up with will be any more palatable to their members, mm-hmm. the troopers themselves. Union officials indicate that without a pretty big raise, troopers will start looking for jobs elsewhere.
All right. Well, story we'll be watching, I guess, as that develops. Noah, thanks as always.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky helping us catch up on all the news from around the state this week. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. President Obama broached the idea of mandatory voting this week when asked about managing the influence of money in politics. Let's give a listen.
In Australia and some other countries, there's mandatory voting. It would be transformative if everybody voted. That would counteract money more than anything. If everybody voted, then it would completely change the political map in this country. Because the people who tend not to vote are young, they're lower income, they're skewed more heavily towards immigrant groups and minority groups.
President Obama on mandatory voting there. Now, actually implementing mandatory voting might be a long shot at most, but we want to hear what you think about the idea. Should freedom in the U.S. continue to include the freedom to not vote? Should people be obliged to vote by law? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can join the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. Ken Mayer joins us now. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison, specializing in elections. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
So what is the argument people make in favor of the idea of mandatory voting?
The idea is that it would make the electorate perfectly representative of the population and encourage engagement with the political process. And however nice the idea might be in theory, as a practical matter, that it's just no way that it's going to be implemented in the U.S.
Right. What are voter turnout rates like in the U.S. Without mandatory voting and probably never having mandatory voting?
In the last few election cycles, turnout in the 2014 midterm was about 38%. Turnout in 2012, the presidential election, was about 59-60%. And both of those are actually, the presidential turnout is a little bit higher than what has been typical over the last 30 years. In contrast, the turnout in countries that around the world that have compulsory voting tend to be well above 80-90%. Australia has it. Their turnout is typically 93-95%. Argentina has it. Their turnout is in the high 70s. Belgium, around 90%. So it's clear that it significantly increases turnout, but it has to be something that is really baked into the political culture of a country, and that just doesn't seem to be consistent with the way that most people in the U.S. think about politics and the role of government.
In those countries that have mandatory voting, is there a sense among the people who are voting, do you think that they're doing things better there, that there's a better outcome, or there's more buy-in because everybody has to participate, or do they have a similar sense of cynicism maybe toward politics that a lot of people here in the U.S. have?
Well, I the only place that I have personal experience of is Australia. I've lived there, and they don't like their politicians in government any more than we like ours, and so it doesn't really seem to do much about enhancing confidence in the system. What it does do is it takes away the need to try to mobilize voters to spend money to get out the vote, and that's something that's enormously expensive, and there is an enormous amount of money spent in the U.S. by parties and interest groups and candidates to try to get their people out because it's very, very expensive, difficult to contact, difficult to engage with people. And so in effect, taking on the responsibility of enforcing or mobilizing voters, it no longer falls to parties and candidates, and it makes it a little easier for them to focus on their messages. But as far as the effect on policy, there really doesn't seem to be a lot of good data one way or the other to suggest that it would move policy to the left or the right. It would probably be close to a wash.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of mandatory voting? As we've mentioned, probably not going to happen in the United States anytime soon, but do you think it should? Would you like to see it? Or if not that, what do you think would be a better way to encourage a bigger voter turnout in the United States and here in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234 is the number to call as we talk to Ken Mayer. And we've got Matt starting us off in Sparta. Matt, hi.
Hi there. Actually, I kind of disagree with your guests. I believe that mandatory voting would push politics toward the left. That's all. I also believe that's why President Obama seems to think favorably about the idea. But my comment, though, was if we do have mandatory voting as a law, I think that people should also be mandated to pass an exam to prove that they know who they're voting for. Because I think a big reason a lot of people don't vote is because they don't care enough to vote. And if they don't care enough to vote, they probably don't know the situation. And if those people were forced to vote, they're not going to know who they're voting for.
Matt, thanks a lot for that call. And Ken, I want to bring up an issue that he kind of points us toward there. Some people say, you know what? Be careful what you wish for when it comes to voter turnout. Are we bringing in a less informed voters who will make less informed decisions? Is that a worry among people who study voter turnout?
It is. One of the effects that that the proponents hope would happen is that if people know that they are expected to vote and could be fined if they don't, that gives them an incentive to invest the time to get up to speed on the candidates. But one of the things you do observe in Australia in particular is a very high rate of invalid ballots, or what they call informal votes. Typically in the U.S., it's ranges around maybe 2-3% of the votes are bad because there are overvotes or undervotes and whatnot. In Australia, that rate is 2-3 times higher, and there's some evidence that at least some of that is due to protests and people submitting blank ballots or writing messages on it. But as the caller sort of hinted at, the issue of sort of testing people to make sure they're up to speed on politics has a long and not very good lineage in the United States as a way of disenfranchising people. But it does cut across the in the last 10 years or so, there's been a lot of effort to actually make voting more difficult, to impose requirements, whether it's photo ID or removing the protections of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. But as far as policy and information goes, the theory is that people need to play a part in the political process, and you can't make prior judgments about who is and is not informed.
So I get a comment from Facebook. Joe writes, find us some candidates worth voting for, and you might be surprised by how many people show up. We need more options, Joe says, besides Republicans and Democrats. And how about a none-of-the-above option while we're at it?
Well, the state of Nevada had that for a couple of elections. You could have the option of none-of-the-above, and it actually would get a non-trivial percentage of the vote. But one of the issues here is that if you were to write down the political pathologies that affect American politics, and there are quite a few of them, there is not a procedural fix to them. And a lot of reforms have been floated, whether it's the jungle primaries, the top two primaries, trying to change campaign finance, lots of different things that have been tried. And those kinds of procedural practices don't really change the way that politics is conducted, the incentives of candidates, and the way that campaigns are run. That's much more of a complicated and overall response to the political environment that candidates are dealing with.
Ken, we'll have to have you on to talk about political pathology sometime, too. I think that's a great starting point for another conversation. Let's go to our callers again. We've got Casey with us in Black River Falls. Casey, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think in a country that's so concerned about personal freedom, what have you, which is rightfully so, the term mandatory sets a certain spin or connotation to it. From what I've read, my understanding is that a lot of these countries, if you don't choose a participate, they're not going to lock you up, but you lose access to certain government-funded programs and what have you.
All right, Casey, thanks a lot. And that was one of the points you alluded to earlier, Ken. This just doesn't feel consistent with how we think of politics in the U.S.
Right. So in Australia, again, to use the example that I'm most familiar with, you're fined. The fine is $20, and some people don't vote and just pay it. But you can wind up facing sanction and being jailed if you refuse to pay the fine. Now, the argument that Australian supporters of this make is that there are other forms of compulsory activity that fall upon citizens. Jury duty, for example, or paying taxes, lots of compulsory activities. But voting is I think different, particularly in the U.S. context. I think that there's absolutely zero chance that the public would stand for it, and the levels of compliance that you get. If you had 10% non-compliance in the U.S., you're talking about 10 million people, 15 million people being potentially fined, and that's just a logistical impossibility.
Time for a quick call from Jim in Appleton. Jim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was just I was thinking that the biggest problem, it seems, that people don't want to vote is because they don't believe that their vote really counts. With the Electoral College in place, the popular vote kind of takes a sidestep to that. Do you believe that if we went for a popular vote, that we would get more voters and then they would feel that that would be that their vote would be important?
Jim, thanks. Ken, just a brief answer.
Probably not. That the real effect of voting has to do with the fact that an individual vote will typically have very little effect on the outcome. And it's not the Electoral College that's driving that. In fact, voting in the presidential elections is significantly higher than it is for any other kind of election. So it's not something that people feel disengaged. The survey data shows that people who don't vote really don't necessarily feel more disillusioned about politics than people who do vote.
We'll leave it there. Ken Mayer, thanks for joining us. More to come here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Monday. One of the most contentious topics in Governor Walker's budget proposal has centered around the UW system. The governor's plan, in basic details, a $300 million funding cut over the next 2 years and more flexibility for the university to manage itself as a public authority. But Republican lawmakers who would need to sign off on the governor's plan have raised major objections, including fears of tuition increases. Whatever ends up happening, it'll probably look very different than the governor's original idea. Another sticking point for some Republican leaders, UW Regents has said that under a public authority, they would keep their commitment to faculty tenure and what's called shared governance. Short version, that means faculty and staff and students have some say in decision making. In response, some lawmakers have said the UW isn't ready to run itself and they might step in on those issues. Our next guest is worried about what that can mean for the university system. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is here in the studio. She's Associate Professor of Educational Policy Studies and Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She co-wrote a piece on this issue in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, what is shared governance? How does it work?
Well, shared governance, in a sense, is a form of joint decision-making that takes place only around the issues in a university that are central to academic affairs, right, and central to the education of students. In a sense, it's kind of a form of checks and balances as it currently works, where you have faculty, staff, and students working with the administration on issues where people might have different vantage points. Right. So you could expect someone who teaches the students to have a different vantage point than an administrator, for example, or a student to have a different vantage point. What it means in the current system is that we all sort of have a right to be at the table in those discussions.
So this might feel like an alien concept for people outside the university system. Might think, you know, I don't get to shared govern where I work. So what's different about a university that it needs something like that?
Right. And I have to admit that when I first came here to Wisconsin, I didn't know what it was either. And I kind of wondered what all these committees are, because frankly, there is a lot of work involved in performing shared governance, and it does take commitment. I think that certainly we can understand that maybe at a business there is a specific thing that you want to achieve, say, make a profit. But in an institution, in a university, there are many different things that we want to achieve. So for example, we might have different goals. One goal might be to get good college graduation rates, right? Another goal might be to make college extremely affordable, to ensure that people can be there. Another goal might be to make us look very prestigious, right? To have good rankings from, say, the U.S. News and World Report. Because there are multiple competing goals, it's especially important to have multiple stakeholders at the table in making those decisions.
I think the argument from some lawmakers on this seems to be chancellors, regents need more authority and flexibility to do things like save money, make cost-saving decisions. things like shared governance get in the way of that. Is that true? Is that how it plays out in practice?
You know, I know that's their hypothesis, and I can certainly understand that. You know, CEOs like to believe, for example, that they will always maximize the bottom line better than anyone else. And as any employee knows in a business, though, sometimes a CEO fails to see the ways in which money is actually being wasted. In this case, that hypothesis does not seem to bear out in the data. So there has been a really nice empirical study that was done by someone actually at the American Enterprise Institute who was questioning the role of shared governance and asking the question, maybe this is something we could cut to save money. Mm-hmm. What he found, though, to his surprise, was that over time, as the role of faculty, students, and staff in decision making has been diminished, and it has over time, the college costs have actually risen more. And the way to think about this is because, as I said before, this is a system of checks and balances. In a system in which there's no shared governance, there's really nobody to check the clear desire sometimes of a chancellor to simply raise tuition and make more money.
I've been saying Republican lawmakers, but do university chancellors in the UW system want this flexibility? Do they want to get rid of or limit maybe shared governance?
I think it's hard to tell. You know, I mean, I think right now what they really want are flexibilities on other aspects. Mm-hmm. And what they're willing to do in order to get those aspects, including things like procurement and other sorts of business type things, it's hard to know. I don't know if we're hearing from these chancellors what they really believe or not. They're certainly telling us that they're very supportive of shared governance. They say they don't want it to go away.
Another issue that's come up, and you refer to it in that Milwaukee Journal Sentinel piece I mentioned, is tenure. From the outside, I think tenure can be looked at as a cushy lifetime gig for professors. But make the case. Why do you think it benefits the university, the students who go there?
Well, I think for several reasons. I mean, I think that, first of all, it should be clear to any parent of a student that the people who often know their students the best are the people who are in the classrooms with them. If you ask the students, that's pretty much what they're going to say. Now, oftentimes, it's the case that we can do a really nice job of educating a student in a way that our administrators might discourage us from doing. So, I mean, in one sense, we face some difficulty in being straightforward with our students and asking hard questions. I'm probably a very good example. You know, I mean, I'm somebody who, in my professional life, I analyze the policies of universities. Well, in some cases, I may be critical of, you know, my institution's decision to try to maximize revenue at the expense of students. If I didn't have tenure, I could be fired for doing so. Am I serving the Wisconsin taxpayer by raising those questions? I'd argue absolutely yes. So that's one reason, is around academic freedom. There are multiple reasons, including, by the way, the fact that we're willing to trade wages for tenure. So if we were not tenured, you'd have to pay us a lot more to get us to do these jobs.
And that is another concern that people have had about the university system lately. Some big names leaving the state, going elsewhere to other universities. Are you worried that the cumulative effect of maybe budget cuts, maybe these changes in governance, maybe changes in tenure would boost that trend?
I mean, I think that we certainly have to worry about that. I think that losing our colleagues, especially when it comes to the quality of our research at our research institutions, I think we're going to need to be scared about that. And I worry about the demoralization of the people who are in the classrooms with our students right now. You know, if I was a parent of a Wisconsin undergraduate right now, I would not like the way that my faculty that are teaching my students are being made to feel, right, as if they weren't supposed to be there and they're getting up every day and having to come in and educate our students. So I do worry about that. I also think, though, that there's a much broader issue here, right, which is how we do cost-effective education in the state of Wisconsin. And I think you'll find that the faculty and the students and the staff want that, too. Unfortunately, the way that this is being talked about, it sounds like it's going to save money. I don't think it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, the university may be forced to save money one way or the other with proposed $300 million over the next 2 years in budget cuts across the system. Maybe it'll be less than that. That is still very much in flux now. Looking at those proposed cuts, what are you worried about with the impact of those?
The first thing I'm worried about is actually what looks like a cut to the system that would save taxpayers money won't. Because what's going to happen as a result of this is that the buck is going to be passed to the taxpayers to then pay a lot more money when they want to send their students to our institutions.
Well, lawmakers are trying to have some kind of, or have floated at least, I don't want to put anything down because this is constantly changing, but freezing tuition is part of whatever budget deal comes out of this. So
right, and that sounds good. That sounds good. It sounds like, okay, so we're not going to have to pay more in tuition. But when you send your child to an institution where they can't raise tuition and they don't have appropriations, you're going to see higher fees in other areas where they do have discretion. And very importantly, your child's going to have a very difficult time getting access to the courses they need to graduate on time. So it is this kind of sneaky passing of the buck where your child all of a sudden will take 5 years to finish college instead of four. Like I said, it sounds good on the face of it, but higher education finance is complicated enough that I think the Wisconsin taxpayer is going to get hurt.
One flexibility that's been talked about is allowing the system, campuses, to take in more out-of-state students. That obviously affects some campuses much more than others. The university can charge them more than the in-state students, so that can help make up for some of the budget cuts.
Right, and I think that these sorts of proposals need to be evaluated for their effects on educational quality across the board. It shouldn't just be thought about in terms of a revenue stream. We have to take a hard look at what that will do to all students, including the in-state students. For example, out-of-state students who we would attract would tend to come from higher-income families who are accustomed to certain kinds of amenities. They are much more likely to come to our campus and demand the amenities are improved on our campus. They will therefore vote, for example, to increase segregated fees, which then have to be paid by everyone at the institution, including the Wisconsin students. So this is sort of, again, one of those complicated matters that looks really straightforward. And it's why I think we need the checks and balances so that, for example, our chancellors who advocate for these things can be asked hard questions and taxpayers can get answers.
We're talking to Sarah Goldrick-Rabb about the ongoing debate over the UW system budget and possible changes to the way the system is run. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about proposed budget cuts and about changes that would give university officials more flexibility, more authority to make changes, maybe at the expense of faculty tenure, less input from faculty, staff, and students on how the campuses are managed? Do you have thoughts or questions about how all of this is going to affect students? Maybe you, if you are a student or you have a child getting ready for college, or do you work in the UW system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, Professor of Educational Policy Studies and Sociology at the UW-Madison, talking about proposed budget cuts at the UW system and possible changes to the way UW schools are run, including faculty tenure and what's called shared governance, where faculty and staff and students have input into decision-making. Call now with your thoughts and your questions about how all of this works at 800-642-1234. Especially like to hear from students, families of students, alumni, people who work in this system, or if you want to see changes like this happen, call 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. We've got James on the line in Eau Claire. James, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
Well, as a junior at UW-Eau Claire, I'm a little bit concerned. I have been planning for a four-year graduation, and with these changes that are coming up, there's so much uncertainty, and I really wouldn't like to delay graduation because I've been really involved on campus and have really stayed engaged with the advising process. So for these cuts to happen and for all this uncertainty, it makes me really nervous.
James, thanks a lot for the call. Do you hear this from your students, Sarah?
Of course we're hearing this from our students. I mean, frankly, we've taken cuts multiple times before, and each time we've seen this sort of thing happen where there, you know, aren't nearly as many courses, sections, you know, teachers available to do this kind of work. Academic advising gets cut. I think that he should be worried. I very much have to say that's why those of us that are speaking out right now are risking ourselves by doing that on behalf of these students.
James, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Fred now, also in Eau Claire. Fred, hi.
Hi. Say, my question is a little bit different, but looking at the UW system, it seems to me there are, I think, what, about 13 four-year colleges. There are, I don't know, about the same number of two-year campuses. There are technical colleges all around the state. And in an age when we're going to more online learning and, you know, that sort of thing, I guess I'm wondering why it is we need so many campuses as part of the system, and is that something that anybody has looked at as a way to minimize or eliminate redundancy.
I think absolutely. I think you're raising a question that is on the minds of many people. I will say, of course, I do believe it has been discussed. And I would say that the issue, once again, I don't mean to make everything sound like it's complicated, but in this case, it really very much is. Many of our campuses carry debt loads that the other schools would have to absorb if a campus was closed. I would also say that, as you know, our transportation systems across the state are not really fabulous. And what that means is that it is difficult, if an institution is not located near you sometimes, to save money by living at home and going to school if it's very far away. You're right that online is happening, but I also want to remind you that there's not really good broadband access across our state yet. So I think what you're talking about is something that could be better visited in the future when we've made more investments in technology and transportation.
Fred, thanks for the call. John in Milwaukee is with us now. John, hi.
Hey, I love the UW system, but I just think there's too much fat in it, and I think if they can't find 2.8% cuts to not impact the student, I mean, it's not that much money. I think it's getting blown out of proportion. And you can use a number of millions as you wish, but it's not that big a cut. And I think they can cut without affecting the students' deliverable that they get. That's my comment. I just don't think it's that big a deal. I think they should, like we all do at home, 2.5%. I can find that out. I can find that in a day.
John, thanks a lot for the call.
You know, John, I've heard this from a lot of folks, and I have two responses. One might surprise you, actually, a little bit. So first, I hear you on the 2.8%, but actually when it comes out of the instructional side of the house, what we actually use to teach students, which is where the money has to come from, I believe it's closer to about 13%. And we're already down quite a bit in terms of resources for the actual teaching. So like if we could pick up money that was being used for buildings or something like that and use that because of the, you know, to deal with this cut, I think that we would, but I don't think we can. I also have to say that I would just be cautious about generalizing about fat all the way across system. So I would agree with you. There are certain institutions that may be better equipped to take a cut than others. But I think that, unfortunately, 85% of students in this state attend institutions with very little fat. They aren't research universities. Frankly, Madison has more resources than anyone else, but you're going to feel this cut far more at the other schools, including the ones nearest your home.
Time for one more caller. We've got Joshua with us in Kenosha. Joshua, hi.
Hi, I'm a student who wants to return to school. I'd like to, you know, eventually go back, but, you know, I spent 5 years over at UW-Stout. Do you think that the percentage of students going back to school will be lowered now with these cuts?
I think it's possible. And look, I mean, there's been a lot of research done on how price sensitive students are, especially, you know, those who are not lucky enough to be very well off and have lots of resources. Folks really are concerned about the price point. And I think they're especially concerned when they're looking at a place like returning to Stout. But as I said before, you got to not only worry about the price, you got to worry about whether the classes you need are going to actually be there, even if you pay the price. So I think these are legitimate concerns. And this is what the legislature needs to hear from us, is that we're worried about this.
Joshua, thanks a lot for the call. Sarah, as we start to wrap up, you were worried about high tuition on campuses, you know, before all of this came through in the budget. So what are your hopes and your fears now as we move forward on this still, as I said, a live topic?
Right. I mean, I continue to be concerned about it. I think that, unfortunately, even though we have been talking about this in Wisconsin for a very long time, there still has not yet been a thoughtful commission to think about what rational tuition setting looks like in the state of Wisconsin, what people can afford to pay, and how we should measure, right, what's a good and bad decision to raise tuition. But I, you know, as much as I appreciate people like Robin Voss's attention to issues of costs, I worry that, in fact, they're taking an overly simplistic view about how to get there, and we have to get together and really study this issue. And I don't see why we wouldn't do that before making strong and, you know, abrupt decisions like that are those in this budget bill.
And on tenure and shared governance and funding, do you think that the university system is speaking anywhere near in one voice, chancellors, faculty, students?
No, I don't think that they're going to speak in one voice. I think there's an effort to make them speak in one voice. But I have to say, I think that the people in Wisconsin are better served by hearing the diversity of voices that are coming out right now. Because if the idea that there'd be one opinion on this, I think we all know better than that. This is way too complicated.
All right, Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us
today. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Sarah Goljic-Rabb. She's a professor of educational policy studies and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about proposed cuts and changes to the way campuses are run. You can hear more about this on the Joy Cardine Show Monday morning during the State Capitol Report. Joint Finance Committee co-chair John Nygren will be talking about this and other budget issues. Supporters of public education were among the groups that made a strong showing at the legislature's budget hearing in Milwaukee today. Others spoke up as well during the all-day session, and Republican lawmakers indicated they want more answers from Governor Walker about his state budget proposal. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Several school district superintendents from the Milwaukee area asked lawmakers to drop the governor's plan to trim per-pupil funding aid by about $150 per student. Then Wauwatosa parent Karen Suarez-Flint took her turn at the microphone.
All right, I would invite anyone in the audience who likes public education to stand up.
Despite the co-chairs of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee trying to discourage demonstrations at the hearing, more than 100 people in the audience stood. Next, Suarez-Flint gave her opinion of the governor's proposal.
When Governor Walker's sons attended the TOSA schools, state law provided a $250 increase each year. Why are my daughters worth less than his sons? Why is it that we could afford to pay for his children, but he can't afford to pay for ours?
Prior to the hearing, Joint Finance co-chair Alberta Darling, a Republican senator from River Hills, acknowledged concerns about education funding.
We'd like to put more resources into K-12 education. If we have any more resources, we'll find that out in April or May, and we need to see where we could go from there.
New state revenue figures are expected in the next 2 months. Some Republican leaders are already suggesting another proposed education trim. The governor's proposed $300 million cut for the UW system will be softened. Several UW students testified today in favor of protecting money for the university. UW La Crosse student body president Kaylee Otterbacher.
UWL alone needs to cut $12 million. And I hear a few supporters of the $300 million cut saying that you can trim the fat, you can cut your inefficiencies. But I guarantee that none of those people who are saying that are at the table watching us do this. It's very difficult to cut those inefficiencies.
One more Walker budget proposal that could be in for some changes is the governor's plan to revamp long-term care programs for the elderly and disabled. While the Walker administration contends it's a reform that would end fragmented delivery, a disabled care recipient, Reverend Gaynor Hunter, says she's afraid she would lose services like transportation.
I don't drive anymore, so if I didn't have the transportation, I would have to stay at home. I would totally be lost if I was not able to do the things that I like to do.
Some Republican Joint Finance Committee members say they're not clear on how the governor's long-term care plan would work. Brookfield Representative Dale Coinga says the public is short on details.
They deserve some certainty in the fact of what is my care going to look like going forward. And I think that we are in the position to look at what's out there and put some parameters on there or say, should this be dealt with at a different time? I don't know. We got to talk to the team about that.
Other parts of the Walker budget that drew comments in Milwaukee included dollars for drug and alcohol treatment, proposed cuts in scientist staffing at the DNR, and the governor's plan to help build a new basketball arena in Milwaukee. The Joint Finance Committee's next budget hearing will be Monday in Rice Lake. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is back on Monday. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.